Welcome to the Ethics Experts, where we're elevating ethics and compliance and HR to the strategic level it's supposed to be.
Hey, everybody. Welcome to the Ethics Experts. Thanks for joining us today. I'm Giovanni Gallo. Very excited to host you for the Ethics Experts podcast featuring Brian Bridson. Welcome to the cast, Brian.
Thank you very much for having me. It's a pleasure to be here.
So in case you don't know, Brian is a professional ethics, policy, and employee relations professional. He has a bunch of great experience. He's a global ethics advisor he's worked with the Canadian Food Inspection Agency and Boeing. He's really well versed in business partnering and ethics and epistemology, one-on-one group advising, management of global ethics helpline and case intake, and a bunch of other things, including investigations. In case you haven't seen him, he's a regular contributor to this ongoing discussion that we have here on Ethics Experts and otherwise around organizational ethics. And what I've seen, Brian, is you're a great advocate for ethics being recognized as this specific and separate discipline in the organization, where, you know, this dialogue is really a necessary component of any healthy organizational culture. Brian, I personally love the stuff that you write, your contributions to discussions and engagement and this community. I think that this ethics community is a real community where we help each other, where we help each other do a better job and take care of people. And I just really admire the way that you contribute, where that you help drive this forward. And I'm really excited to have you on the podcast today, man.
Well, thanks very much. And thanks for the kind introduction.
So what I'd love to start with is, you know, we believe that ethics is about people. You know, we can talk about culture and function and, you know, different things that we do in order to get an ethical, integrity-focused organization. But ultimately, this matters when it affects the lives of people, helps people make better decisions so that we can kind of go after the mission that we're about in our organization. So to that end, let's talk about you first, Brian. Talk to us about how you came to be in this profession and how you kind of came to build your career in this. You know, kind of what led you here, Brian?
I fell into ethics itself kind of unintentionally. My initial intentions were to go into international development. And, you know, towards the end of my first year, I realized it wasn't for me. And the only thing I really enjoyed working on had to do with ethics itself. So I switched degrees and went straight full on into philosophy, focusing a lot on ethics and through ethics, its relationship to epistemology or theory of knowledge and the role that plays in how we come to the ethical frameworks that we have. And I was also very heavily influenced by Friedrich Nietzsche. And specifically his concept of to what extent can the truth be incorporated? And that is the question, that is the experiment. And that has always rang a very clear bell for me in terms of what we mean by integrity. And it's never becoming too assured of yourself or the position you have to always go back and reflect and make sure that where you're at and what you think is best going forward really does reflect really what the best thing should be on all that knowledge that you have access to. And of course, in the context of, you know, whether it's a relationship in your personal life or it's a business or other organization, really needing to come together and have those holistic views of what's happening in the organization, what those risks are, the types of decision-making people are making. And again, it all gets tied back to this general understanding I have of what it means to be ethical in the first place and have integrity by way of that. And the other takeaway I have from Nietzsche would be in his book, Also Spake Zarathustra. Zarathustra has his disciples crowding around him and, you know, really just adoring him. And, you know, they think he's all that and then some. And he says, you know, why do you pluck at Zarathustra's laurels? Perhaps Zarathustra has deceived you. Perhaps Zarathustra has deceived himself. And so that again comes back to what this ultimate concept I have of what it means to be ethical is. Like, it's really that integrity and honesty in how you approach all of your decisions. And certainly that has ramifications for certainly the way I view what would be ethical for an organization as well.
Yeah, it's great. I love, I love that you can integrate these, you know, philosophical approaches into this, you know, what ends up at some point being a very practical application of, well, what should we do as ethics professionals to drive a better culture, to help people make better ethical decisions and have behavior that, you know, is more representative of the integrity that we shoot for. And, you know, I love that you bring that up. There's a certain amount of balance that we have between seeking that truth and what do we know and how should we do something, and this humility of, well, maybe, you know, maybe I, just like Zarathustra, have something to work on and can be better at.
Absolutely. Absolutely.
Where do you think that we as ethics experts are in kind of the evolution of this profession, and kind of what do you think is kind of the next frontier that, you know, everyone's kind of on their own path and every organization has its own thing that is challenged with. What do you think are some big things that people are kind of thinking about working on right now that, you know, hopefully we'll be better at in the next couple of years as we continue working on them?
Well, I think, you know, relative to some other functions in the organization, whether it be law, HR, even compliance, ethics is still relatively new to the game. And certainly, you know, it's been around a little bit longer in some places rather than others. Sometimes or often, it's because we've had enough things happen in the past that we've seen the need to legislate or legally require something to be put in place. But ultimately, the discipline itself is still young, and it's trying to find its home in organizations in a way that's going to be most effective for it, both in terms of how it can effectively business partner with others, but be seen as standing independent enough in that organization so that, you know, if we say there is an ethics function in that organization, I hope we want employees, management, and all of our stakeholders, whether it be the community, suppliers, et cetera, know that we take it seriously and we mean that. And that, you know, there's a place you can go to that or in that organization, regardless of where you work and what your issue might be, where you have confidence that you will be taken seriously, and that, you know, these things we talk about, like, you know, no reprisals as a result of coming forward in good faith, that those things will be taken seriously, and that when ethics has something to say in the organization, that's not necessarily being diluted by what another function may think might be more important or more relevant to the organization. So I think ultimately we want to see it as an independent function in the organization. I know that I'm not alone in that, but I'm also, I wouldn't say in the majority on that view either. And I've butted heads a few times with people on LinkedIn, trying to put this viewpoint out there. And so far there seems to be a fair bit of folks who are coming on board and say, yeah, you know what, law, compliance, those are different things. Those are different things that require different mindsets. I'm not saying that's across the board, but certainly it's coming along. But we're not quite there with ethics. It's still seen in some respects as a child, as it were, to whether it's law, whether it's compliance, whether it's HR. I was fortunate enough when I worked with the Canadian Food Inspection Agency specifically that I came in when it was still very early, the program was developing, and we were actually able to make the case and have it stand independently within the organization, reporting directly to the board, not through another VP or another function in the organization. And so perhaps I carry quite a bit of that with me. I'm indebted in that sense to Ann Fraser with the CFIA for her taking that as seriously as she did and really throwing that support behind it to ensure that we did get that independent function within the organization. Because it wasn't always easy when we were still that child of HR trying to get our point across in a way that it didn't become just another part of HR's message or watered down in it in some way. So really getting that independence gave us a lot of flexibility to ensure we were getting elements in place that we needed to have in place and helped us leverage our whistleblowing program at the agency as well and ensuring that it also stayed independent from other functions in the organization. We didn't call it whistleblowing. It was the Public Servants Disclosure Protection Act, commonly referred to as internal disclosure in the Canadian public service.
Got it.
So I bring that with me to those discussions. And it's not to say that you couldn't have an excellent leader in another function who truly got what it was about and that they couldn't be a wonderful advocate for ethics. There's not going to be a one-size-fits-all solution, and I don't think we should expect it, just like we don't see necessarily a one-size solution for a lot of other functions and the way different functions interact with one another. But it definitely needs to have that, to have a good degree of independence at the very least and be seen as independent in that sense. And I also make the case that, again, isn't necessarily entirely popular, that our ethics professionals, or at the very least those that are leading the program, shouldn't necessarily be picked because they have that experience in compliance or because they have that experience in law. Again, not to say that you can't have the lawyer or the compliance professional who gets it, who gets the mentality, understands what's needed, and understands the mentality is different when you're coming at it from an ethics perspective rather than compliance or rather than law. But it does require a certain type of mindset. And it's not just, you know, what is legal or, you know, what is compliant. It's going over and above and having higher ideals. And, you know, some of the pushback would be, you know, well, law can do this and has been doing those things for a while. And I say, well, why do we keep having more regulations? You know, why did organizations that would claim to be ethical rely on child labor? Or why did they think it was okay, lacking regulations, to go ahead and dump their waste in the local river, for example?
Yeah, and I think it's a great point that as we're talking about this concept of ethics, you know, we hear these personal stories on the ethics experts a lot, and people come from all kinds of places, from accounting or legal or HR or, you know, nursing or whatever it might be. And it seems like maybe it's personality, maybe it's some, you know, common types of experience that we've had, but someone realizes, okay, that's a piece of the puzzle, but to have an actualized ethical organization, it takes a bit of a different approach. And to your point, it's helpful to have some of those things in the background or those people to have seats at the table. But ultimately, we're kind of focusing and trying to go somewhere a little bit different from, you know, someone who just has a pure legal mindset.
Absolutely. Absolutely.
I'd love to talk a little bit in a minute about kind of where that's going and how that happens, but I'd love to hear a little bit more about your experience in CFIA, and you were there as this transformation happened that brought ethics to a different level and made it more independent. What do you think allowed that to happen? Was it a champion? Was it kind of a shift in the culture? That doesn't happen everywhere. I think a lot of people are, you know, kind of on that path. But, you know, what kind of made that happen or allowed that to happen? And then, you know, maybe we can talk about what was different.
Well, I got to hand it to the Canadian Public Service in the sense of how seriously they took it. And a lot of the inspiration from the Canadian Public Service actually came from the Australian Public Service. And I'd be remiss not to mention that. But when the CFA was starting and the program was starting to mature a bit, when I came in, there were some other programs already functioning well within the government who already had some of these structures set up. So part of what we did when it came time to making a case for our independence in the organization was going around and talking to, you know, 20 other departments and agencies in the government, understanding how their programs work from, you know, where do they sit hierarchically within the organization? What are their responsibilities? What do their training programs look like? Et cetera. And based on that information and some of the best practices or literature at the time, we were able to put together a case. And I'd say it was that, but it really was Ann Fraser took her role seriously. She really, she saw reasons for there needing to be a change and for there to be a very strong function. And, you know, she went to bat every day and worked to make it happen. So it wouldn't have happened without her, but we weren't the only ones out there that did take that approach.
Yeah, that's great. There are a bunch of things in there. You had some examples, you did some research, you had a champion, you made the case. I think a lot of those things need to come together. Maybe one of those legs doesn't let the stool stand. But it's great that you and Anne and the rest of the team were able to come together and get that accomplished. As that happened, what did you see change in the way that that team was able to make an impact, or that, you know, the entire organization changed? You know, maybe that's some things from the top and how you got attention, or maybe some things from, you know, kind of the broader population of how they viewed ethics and how safe they were. What was different when you kind of got that seat at the table and your ethics team was reporting directly to the board, kind of had an independent stance?
Well, one of the things we were able to do is actually, once we had that independence, setting up a line for individuals to call and file, you know, concerns that they had. We had the email going at that point. This is still relatively early when it came to solutions.
Yeah.
We had that going. We worked on integrating ourselves within the organization. Again, so we could get that holistic, as much of that holistic approach as we could when it came to, you know, receipt of allegations. We knew that we needed to rely on HR, we needed to rely on finance, we needed to rely on security. So actually setting up those formal relationships for information sharing as we had those cases came in or come in, as well as really trying to assure some of the leadership were still very unfamiliar with this sort of process at that time, that it wasn't, we weren't setting this up as a way to derail them or threaten, you know, their own roles in the organization, because there was some of that, especially, it's not to say there aren't any ethics functions in Canada, but it's not terribly popular outside of the public service, barring, say, international organizations. That have a presence here. So for a lot of people seeing this happen in their own organization, when they didn't have any sort of experience with it, and probably none of their colleagues in the public sector, or sorry, the private sector, had much experience with it, it was a little rattling. But, you know, working diligently, business partnering, and just letting people know that you're not there for any nefarious purposes, you're there to help. And that, you know, we're all in it together at the end of the day. It takes time. You have to build that trust, especially when you're coming in, nobody knows what the hell you were in the first place.
Yeah, what's, you know, this good it's, thing it's on not, the org chart? Why are you guys
yeah,
over here
exactly.
now? And, you know, I mean, exactly. I think some people are going to, there's some psychology around, you know, they're going to be worried about that fear of loss and like, well, how is this going to mess me up? And I love, Brian, how you highlight that you work diligently and you built those bonds and you build that trust. You know, we talk about trust and ethics, and, you know, people need to trust the organization and the process to be a whistleblower and things like that. I think a lot of times people view that as just kind of the organization to the frontline whistleblowers, but we also need that partnership with these other business lines and these other business units, these other, you know, kind of mid and high level leaders within the organization, because that's when the magic really starts to happen, where it's not like, oh, I'm talking to your people to find a problems with what you're doing, but hey, when this stuff works, then finance is going to be operating better. And, you know, innovation is going to happen and people are going to be safer and your manufacturing line is going to hurt fewer people or whatever it is. I love that you highlight how the team that's leading that, the ethics team, needs to kind of build those bonds and set those expectations and frame that for people to say, okay, yeah, I could buy into that.
Absolutely. Absolutely. And what I found refreshing again with Ann Fraser was, not only did we create the training ourselves, not only did we deliver ourselves, not only did we ensure that every manager in the organization took the training, at a time when, again, there wasn't a whole lot of precedent necessarily for, especially here in Canada, and certainly nobody in our organization was pushing for it outside of us. But we were able to do it. Not only did we do the training, not only did we make those connections, but we were able to get that feedback that we needed from people too. We were able to hear what their problems were, and we took action. And one of the big challenges that was identified from our people was that because food inspection, we're going out, we're inspecting all those facilities that are involved in food manufacturing, and saying, okay, well, you want us to live by these values, which is great. But then we have these people over here that don't have those values necessarily, or they don't necessarily all line up the way they ought to. And so it's sometimes going to be a challenge, or is challenging, for us to go in there and operate the way we think is appropriate, given the values that we have, as well as all the, you know, the policies, the regulation, everything else. And so we actually crafted a document we call an ethical relationship, and made that available for all of our staff who have these interactions with regulated bodies, so that they could clearly communicate without getting necessarily tripped up if they're not, because we're not all comfortable having these conversations and explaining things, that they would be able to give to the people that they're working with, so that they could better understand sort of what our limitations, our restrictions, and what our ultimate values are when it comes to interacting with you. But at the same time saying, we also respect your values, and we're not ever going to put you in a position where we're asking you to compromise anything that would violate something that you consider, you know, important to integrity or what have you. So really listening and showing that you're listening, showing that these concerns are important, by taking action and making sure that those tools are available, so that your people no longer feel handicapped when it comes to trying to do their jobs, and to, you know, not just follow the law, not just follow all the compliance measures that are in place, but living up to those higher standards that you're putting in place.
Yeah, there's a lot in there that's around, you know, this idea where for us to be successful as ethics experts, we can't just be a competing viewpoint that says, listen to me instead of your manager. We have to show that what we're trying to do, an ethical organization operating with integrity, it fits with this. And, you know, let's see how this makes everything better, rather than, hey, you know, that kind of more policing policy focused aspect that says, hey, well, you know, this is what you should do, and I'm going to enforce it if I want to get you to do it.
Absolutely. And I found it terribly important when it came when I was with Boeing. Okay. Really having those dialogues, reaching across the table. You know, every organization has challenges with behavioral problems. You know, my manager said this, or, you know, my coworker doesn't like me, or, you know, they get a little more serious than that, but they still fall into, you know, more behavioral type issues. And, you know, managers are always going to be on a, you know, receiving a certain amount of that just because of the position that they're in. one of the things I found most effective in helping to drop the number of behavioral issues that we were seeing was just talking to managers, sitting down with them over the lunch hours. What's going on? You know, here's the latest information that we have in terms of our metrics. You can see we've had these types of cases. You can see, you know, this is where it's changed from last month. You know, this is starting to pick up. You know, here's some information on that in case you need it. But what's bothering you? You know, is there anything I can do to help you better? Because I don't want to keep getting these cases coming in. I'd rather spend my time doing other things. And you would rather spend your time doing other things and not being investigated or not being called down to HR to answer some questions or, you know, whatever else the case may be. What can we do to help you? And they say, well, I don't really know how to talk about this. Or, you know, and one of the issues that kept popping up was, I don't know how to effectively have a conversation with my staff about the difference between personal values and organizational values. Huh. I don't know how to comfortably and, you know, perhaps even without unintentionally insulting the other person, too. But to have that conversation and say, it's not to say you're a bad person. It's not to say your values are out of whack. It's to say we're, you know, and there's got to be, you know, I hope we overlap to some degree. I hope there's that. But, you know, when you come in here and you're working, we have certain standards. And you have to live by that and you have to be okay with it. And if you're not, you know, a vegan would never probably be a good person to work in a slaughterhouse.
Right.
You know, you can make all the ethical arguments you want. They've already heard them. They're still going to supply that meat. So maybe it's not the best place for you to go. Maybe a dramatic example, but it makes a point.
Yeah, I mean, sometimes it's going to be a bridge too far, but a lot of times the things that maybe lead to misbehavior, and you know, there are a lot of you know, psychology and brain science studies that kind of look at where do ethics come from and what makes someone choose their morality and things like that, and you know, you start realizing that okay, well, they're choosing this loyalty over this loyalty. Or they're choosing, you know, kind of sticking to this thing that they're used to instead of this thing that, you know, this broader tribe needs them to do. And I love that you're taking this to, you know, I think this is where the profession is moving to. This is kind of the frontier that we're running at, is those conversations reveal a lot of this. Because this is about people, it's about behavior, it's about relationships. So listen, you need to have some things in place. You need to have, you know, a reporting method that's legitimately allowing people to, you know, report anonymously. You need to have some software to track this stuff. You need to be able to audit, you know, you need some tools. But at the end of the day, what is keeping us from fully actualizing or kind of hitting this next stage, this 3.0 stage, is really, okay, well, where is this breaking down? We have the policy. We have the methods, we have the training in place, but it's not all connected. And I love that you bring this down to, well, just talk to somebody and find some time to kind of get out of the PowerPoint presentations and the analysis, or make that stuff easier so that you can kind of go look at someone eye to eye, or I don't know, maybe screen to screen for now, and have a conversation around like, all right, well, why do you think this isn't working? I love it, man.
Yeah, I mean, it's an important step, but to your point, you know, We don't need another procedure written. We don't need another policy. We don't need another law. You know, we're looking for more than that. And if we want this to work in organizations, we need the will to be there first. The will to change and to be different. If we don't have that will to be different, if it's not there at the highest level, it doesn't matter what else you do. It doesn't matter what else you do. If it's not there at the highest levels and working its way down, everybody in that organization is going to see it happening, and they're going to, you know, maybe you'll see the occasional person try to see if something changes, but they're going to know the way things work. Your culture doesn't have to be written down on paper. People see that culture every day.
Yep.
So if you don't have that will in the first place, none of the rest of it's going to happen. Because at the end of the day, you know, senior leadership, the C-suite, the board isn't on. They're not on the same team. If they're not going to play ball that way, it's not going to work.
Yeah.
So you need that will there first and foremost. Otherwise, you're probably fighting an uphill battle the whole time you're there.
Yeah, that's a good point. And, you know, it's some helpful nuance, because I have this discussion with people sometimes where, you know, I'll post something or make a statement about, you know, we as ethics experts, we need to be leading the charge here. We need to be pushing this new frontier. And then someone says, well, it needs to come from the CEO or it's not going to happen. But I think you've experienced it, how, you know, the ethics team can push for it, make the case for it, then be elevated to the top and be part of that top conversation, and then, you know, can kind of transform the way that some other people look at it. And, you know, it's not one or the other. And part of my point when I bring it up is, listen, if the CEO and the board are not on it, and you're a, you know, a chief ethics officer at an organization, well, instead of waiting for them to do it, you know, let's make the case and let's kind of help transform that top instead of waiting for them to, you know, come and ask you for some help. Again, kind of getting to that conversation and getting to that being adopted. But it's a great point that if the will isn't there first, then it's probably not going to happen. If someone doesn't want to get it done, listen, this is why we're still fighting this battle after however many decades or centuries you want to say this has been going on. You know, it still hasn't happened because something isn't right. And you know, that will from the top might be there. And I tend to think that we as ethics experts can help influence that.
Absolutely. Absolutely. You know, ultimately we wouldn't have been successful when I was with the CFIA if the president of the organization hadn't seen her point and the point that we were making. So I think ultimately we had enough of that will to make it happen. I mean, otherwise you're probably looking at groundswells. You get enough happening internally, and we saw the protests from employees with Amazon. At a certain point, people will break, and it's especially if you're saying, you know, we value X and you only do Y, or you're a big fan of doing Y and sometimes do X, we're going to see that backlash, and you'll get a reputation.
Yeah.
And eventually the people that you want to attract won't want to work for you because they've seen and heard enough.
Yeah. And, you know, I think part of it is, you know, if it happens via groundswell or backlash or whatever it is, listen, it's better than a bunch of people suffering under that for a long time, but there's a lot of deadweight loss in there, and there's a lot of you know, kind of unnecessary pain that happens there to the company, to the executives, to, you know, the individuals who are feeling it, who are part of the groundswell. And, you know, I think that part of the approach of ethics is to not just look at it as, well, let's avoid that problem, but let's short circuit whatever's causing that problem so that we don't need to fight a groundswell or react to it and make a nice public statement and remove the executive, but we're actually authentically driving from a place of that will that you talk about, and we're actually kind of rooting these things out and driving good behavior around the organization.
Yeah, and I mean, if we want to get people on board, there has to be those people there who can build that trust. Certainly within leadership, but then within the function itself, you need people who can get that trust. And part of that is not just, you know, winning people over enough, or demonstrating to people enough that you have the character that they expect you to have, or that the profession says you have, that follow through at the end, to say, you know, you identified a potential problem, there is an investigation into said problem. We found that, yeah, there was a problem and steps have been taken. If we're seeing that happen regularly, employees know, awesome, as long as part of the steps taken isn't the person that came forward got kicked out the door as a result. So when it comes to, you know, trying to short circuit these things, as you said, we need to rely on people. We need those people to come forward when we are reaching out, we're having these dialogues, or when they feel the need that, you know, something is just so serious, they need to report it. They need to have that trust and confidence that we're going to do the right thing, and they're not going to be taken advantage of or be subject to reprisal as a result of that. And when people see that people do come forward, they raise serious issues and they're kept around at the end of the day. That also sends that very clear message to people that, yeah, we take it seriously. This isn't just something that, you know, looks good on paper. Or, you know, if we have enough good things on paper, then if we ever do get in trouble, at least, you know, maybe we're not going to get in as much hot water.
Right. Yeah, we had a procedure in place, so don't sue us too hard.
Yeah. Look, it's all right here. Yeah. We checked those boxes, we dotted those I's, and we crossed those T's. It's all there.
So you brought up this Yeah. You've brought up this interesting dynamic for that it seems like for us to advance as a profession and us to really transform cultures and organizations, we need to balance a few different things. We need to have this collaboration with some other departments and we need to get this buy-in. You know, I like this concept of you have a tone from the top, you have a mood in the middle, and ultimately when those align, then everything gets aligned. So you need that collaboration. You need some independence, right? You can't be subject to the values of someone who's focused on something in conflict with ethics. And you also need to have an eye on what's stopping that collaboration, like these potential conflicts, right? Someone saying, hey, well, you know what, you're just going to slow me down. You know, this is just the department of no or whatever it is. You know, if you came into a new organization that was, you know, maybe, you know, they're in kind of the 2.0 phase or they kind of get some of this, where do you think kind of the next big steps would be where people maybe don't, they don't have a grasp on one of those? Like where do you think people are most far behind on those fronts?
I think it's the will.
Okay.
I think we have a lot of good people trying to do really good work in the field. A lot of good people.
Yeah.
But I still think in a lot of organizations that will at the top isn't there. Or that at the end of the day, ethics is rolled into another function. And it doesn't get necessarily the credit it deserves or the attention it deserves for raising the issues that it's bringing forward.
Okay.
I also find people tend to be cool with ethics until all of a sudden ethics is talking to them about something more serious than ethics is a problem. Which I get it. Nobody likes to get in trouble, but.
But if that's the only if that's the only function of ethics that you see, then you're not going to have that will, right?
Well, that's it. That's it. And I mean, at the end of the day, every one of us should be working towards trying to get rid of our function, trying to make that organization work so well and have everybody in that organization so on board and such a strong culture that people wouldn't tolerate things happening. And they know that if they do step up, that they're not going to be canned as a result, and they're not going to be struggling for employment for the rest of their lives because they end up on a list, so to speak.
Right.
And not to mention, you had an interesting conversation on here a while ago with Charlie Middleton.
Yeah.
And he talked about, you know, just in of itself, the challenge of working with some of these external auditing firms. But the money that is spent on hiring these people to come in, and as he said, looking for the needle in the haystack. But going back to everything we were just saying, if we're using our people, and it, you know, to go back to the analogy that Charlie drew, we have all these needles in the sewing basket. And if people take us seriously and they know at the end of the day that, you know, they're going to still be able to provide for their family and that they're not going to be suffering, you know, any sort of reprisal or retaliation, whether that be social, economic, whatever, as a result. When people see that and they know they're valued, not just because of the job they do, because they're out there to look after the best interest of the organization at the end of the day, then you see things changing.
Yeah, that's a great point. And, you know, I think that that's a paradigm shift that, you know, I think we see ourselves in this light, but maybe don't always express it properly that, you know, ethics leaders don't take a bunch of pride and joy in writing somebody a ticket and writing them up and getting them in trouble. But we see that, you know, if there's something wrong, us fixing it is going to keep someone else from suffering, and it's in the best interest of the organization. But, you know, some things you've been talking about, Brian, we may need that relationship, or we may need some kind of leadership and visibility and influence to kind of frame that properly. So people say, hey, you know what? Like, you know, I don't want my division to get in trouble, but I also don't want anyone abusing someone in my division or committing fraud, because that's going to eventually cause a problem. And I think we're living, you know, to me, thankfully, like, I'd rather it not have the problem, but we're thankfully living in a society that more and more the cost of that misbehavior is becoming clearer, and you're kind of getting away with it less, which is a step in the right direction. But, you know, I personally believe that we're going to see an acceleration of that, you know, especially over the next decade, as people start seeing that, you know what, this ethics team, you know, we could have been that headline that we just saw our competitor in, or we could have been, you know, kind of going down this path. Because what a lot of people don't realize is it's not all just bad guys and villains who are messing things up and, you know, making the wrong decisions. A lot of, you know, I mean, there are studies that show that, you know, 98% of people call themselves ethical or say they have integrity. And, you know, there's a higher sampling of misbehavior than that in an organization. So what's the disconnect? Well, it's us as ethics leaders who need to kind of draw that line and say, hey, you might have thought that that was okay because you saw someone else do it, or, you know, it was the culture or whatever. Well, here are our values. And pushing that out, I think, can help people see that we, as an ethics profession, are looking out for the best interests of the whole organization.
Absolutely. And, you know, part of what you're saying, that I know a lot of people don't want to speak up because they are, you know, I can't believe, you know, Johnny did that again. I can't say anything because I know, you know, he just had a kid, you know, his wife's not working, times are tough. Well, that's all well and great, but depending on what Johnny's job is within the organization and what the organization's doing, Johnny continuously screwing something up could have a lot of consequences, and serious consequences, not just for Johnny, but for all these people that he's working with. And, you know, everybody else has family, everybody else has kids and, you know, spouses, or, you know, whatever the case may be, dogs. If you don't do the right thing, if you're not out there looking out for the organization, it's not just going to be Johnny at the end of the day that's out of his job, or possibly out of his job. Your decision to not act could be impacting a whole lot of other people.
Stop
thinking yourself as a rat and more of a, you know, see, by Johnny, I'm looking after all the rest of my colleagues here who are trying to do the right thing every day. Sorry, Johnny, but.
Yeah, like it's not kind of choosing Johnny's side or nothing. It's choosing everyone else who's doing things right, or, you know, kind of going against our values. And I think there's a lot that we can do as we build our influence and as we make the case for this and as we build these ties across departments to say, hey, you know what? I'm not talking about getting somebody in trouble. I'm talking about protecting everybody else. Hey, why don't you look out and be brave and speak up for all these people who are maybe going to suffer under this bad manager or get the division shut down because of fraud? Let's speak up for them, because maybe they're not brave enough, or maybe they don't see it, and you know, ultimately they're going to get blindsided by this bad event if we don't do something about it. And I think there's potentially a disconnect where we as ethics professionals, maybe intrinsically, because we swim in this water all the time, we see all those connections. But, you know, maybe it was part of that paper that you put together, you know, ethical actions or whatever it was called. But, you know, those types of things where we can kind of connect those dots and say, hey, I'm trying to get here to things being clean. We need to make these steps, because if not, we're going to end up over here.
Absolutely. Again, it's letting people see the value you're bringing and letting them know that at the end of the day, there's nothing duplicitous, that, you know, you're not saying one thing and doing another. It comes down to the character of the people you have doing this. Not everybody's going to be able to get trust, and not everybody deserves to get the trust they get. So it's making sure the people that we're putting out there really are the best ambassadors for this.
Yeah.
To get that trust and to build those relationships and to be seen as that one of the elements in the organization that can help stop things before they get too far. So ideally, you know, you call your manager. Ideally, you just call your manager. I don't know if this is right or not. Is this right? Hopefully we get to the point where your manager feels comfortable enough to say, you know what, no. Or you know what? Yeah. Or you know what? Let's go have a chat with, you know, whoever our person is to figure out whether or not this would be appropriate or not. Not everybody's going to be able to do that. And we know that. So over and above going out and having these dialogues and, you know, all the other things that we've been talking about, if we're not, we don't just have that will at the top, if we're not putting the right people on the ground to build these relationships, who can see these holistic pictures and let people know that at the end of the day, you're there for that and to eliminate as many risks before they happen in the first place as possible. And to do so by creating that environment of trust and respect where you know you can speak up and you know that you're going to be thanked for speaking up, not possibly chastised or worse.
Yeah.
And once you have that trust and people see that it's, you know, it's not being misplaced, then we'll start moving towards 3.0. Then we'll get to, you know, effectiveness.
Yeah.
As I said in one of your posts, you know, it's a shame it took the 3.0 to get to effectiveness. But yeah, here we are.
It'd be great if it came faster, huh? It'd be great if back in the 90s we figured this out and all the journalists were bored because there were no scandals to report, huh?
Wouldn't it?
It would. This is just personal. Maybe we're just kindred spirits, Brian, but you take a very direct tone and, you know, some people, kind of push back in your comments on LinkedIn or something that, you know, you're kind of being really direct and kind of making a really clear point. I like it. I think we need it. Do you think that's just kind of a personal preference in how you are? Or do you think that, you know, as ethics professionals, we need to kind of stand stronger and pick up our banner and say, you know what, this is right and I'm not going to stand for it?
Both.
Okay.
I'm not one to beat around the bush with anything. But I take this really seriously. I think it's very important, and I'm getting tired of hearing that we take it important, but we keep seeing evidence to the contrary. And, you know, the first few times, you know, okay, try harder next time, you know, here's a mulligan. But I mean, after a while, you know, if you're playing nice and you're saying, yeah, here's another mulligan, you know, come on, let's try harder. Come on. You're not advancing anything. You're part of the, you're contributing to the problem, even if it's in some small way. And I think that, you know, if we really are serious about 3.0, if we really are serious about these programs being effective, and changing the course of organizations, that we stop hearing about scandal after scandal after scandal after scandal. We need to get there. We're not there. And I think unless we have people that are standing up and, you know, banging the pots and pans together and getting people's attention. And I wouldn't say, you know, trying to antagonize, but not backing away from something that could become adversarial in some way. Because I think we do need to make very clear points. And I think if we stop beating around the bush and we are getting right to the heart of what we think is important, we're going to, at the very least, you know, hopefully stop talking past each other and try to start working on some common ground, or just make it really obvious where we are talking past each other.
Yeah.
And where there's still a lot of work to do. But I don't think it's time to just sit back and, you know, say, please, can we do this? Or I think it's a really good idea if
you want to.
it's not negotiable anymore. It shouldn't have been negotiable for the longest time. It needs to stop being negotiable. And if we want people to take us seriously, we have to act seriously. It doesn't mean always coming with a smile. It doesn't mean backing down. It doesn't mean deferring to somebody else because they've been doing, you know, a certain role for a certain amount of time, or because they have a certain configuration of initials after their name, or whatever the case may be. We need to make some noise, we need to create some change, and we're not going to do it by doing things the way we've always done.
Yeah, we do that. We're going to get the results we've always gotten. And I think that you're part of this movement and you're part of this group of people who see that we need to change this, and we don't need to just wait until we're invited to the table, but we need to pull a chair up and say, hey, you know what, this is good for you, executive, this is good for you, board, this is good for you, you know, department that I'm going to collaborate with. And, you know, we may not have the positional authority within each organization to command that, but we do have the stance and the knowledge of how to make this happen in a way that we can demand it.
Mm-hmm. Absolutely. Absolutely. And again, it comes down to your people. And the character they have and the character they exhibit. And to what extent people are going to trust them enough to work with them. Whether it's reporting a serious allegation or whether it's you're trying to reach out to one of your business partners to come up with a new training tool that's going to help bridge some of the gaps that have been identified between your two functions and hopefully reduce some of that at least potential investigative burden coming in, so that again, you can go out there and focus on helping people do things a bit better or seeing things a bit differently. So at the end of the day, you are reducing the amount that you're spending on chasing after people and enforcement, and you're supporting people instead.
Yeah, that's awesome. Well, if you have any, I'd love to hear any final thoughts, but maybe to give you a second to think about that. You know, we've seen a lot this year around companies responding to COVID or companies responding to, the racial climate or whatever, and then they make this big statement. And you know, I think I saw you say something about this recently where, you know, we say, oh, great, thank you for writing that letter. And then it seems to me like a lot of times that kind of falls off. What do you think we can do as individuals, as people with a certain position within our organization, or you know, with whatever kind of leadership and authority that we have, to make sure that whatever momentum we build, whether it's kind of broadly cultural or within an organization, because for you know, we had a compliance week or whatever it is, what can we do to kind of keep that momentum building, or what do you think we're leaving on the table that we should start picking up?
Well, I think if you're going to make a comment publicly, you got to at least be intelligent enough to know that people aren't going to know it smacks of hypocrisy or whatnot in the first place. And we've seen that in some situations. But I mean, when it comes to your people, with the racial issues that we're seeing right now, one of the things I've been saying for a while is we hear so much about diversity in organizations, but there's, in a lot of cases, very little follow through on the inclusivity part. Mm. I've seen it. I've been involved in the investigations. I've tried working to resolve issues along those lines. But I mean, if an organization wants its people to know that they take diversity seriously, regardless of what the color of your skin is, what your sexuality is, your gender, whatever. You would be demonstrating it every day. It wouldn't just be, you know, you're filling a quota for a certain group of people. And it wouldn't just be that your concept of diversity is, you know, well, we have so many of this group of people, so many of this group of people, so many of this group of people, but all those people really feel that they're not just in your organization to fill a quota. Nobody wants to feel that much of a tool to somebody else, or that much of a tool to somebody else. They want to feel that they're in there and they're valued because they're bringing things to the table. So we do have to make sure that we have that inclusivity when it comes to different racial groups or different people of different sexualities, from different regions, different languages. We need to make sure that people aren't coming to work every day and feeling that they're being ostracized or victimized because they have these traits. We don't want to see that. And certainly, I hope at least in most organizations, they're working awfully damn hard to make sure that's not happening. Mm-hmm. But they're seeing that diversity of thought as well in the organization. And it's not the groupthink. That people really do feel that they've been brought there, not just because of the color of their skin or what have you, but because they have certain experiences, certain training, and that the organization wanted to take advantage of that by having those people actively contribute. And if
express it, they don't even feel magnify it.
Yeah. So, I mean, if the organizations are doing that in the first place, then they don't have to convince their people a whole hell of a lot that they take respect for anybody else seriously, because their employees would know it. And if their employees know it, they're probably singing that company's praises in the first place. And credit to individuals in your own organization for doing the same thing. It speaks when you see employees freely speaking up publicly or via internal surveys or whatnot, and they're putting their name to it and singing your praises to that extent. It shows that you're resonating in some way. It shows that you're getting that respect and that trust that you're looking for, which again speaks to how healthy your organization is or may be. So enough trying to convince the public that you're a good organization. If you're a good organization, it's going to be known because other people are going to be telling everybody else that you're a good organization. And when you're a bad organization, the same thing happens. So, stop talking about it, start doing it.
Yeah, that's great. If you have anything else you want to wrap up on, I'd love to hear it, but I feel like that's a great thing for us to put a pin in and to keep an eye on. Don't talk about it, be about it. A 2-page letter is not going to change everything. And, I think that our whole profession needs to move from, if an organization is more like an organism and we're all tied together, you can kind of get the bad stuff out and detoxify and get that stuff out. But being healthy is a different piece. And that should be naturally expressed, not just a commitment to I'm going to start exercising to kind of, compare it to an individual, but to actually do it. And, it's naturally expressed. It's, people are saying it for you instead of you telling them what they should think that you feel.
Absolutely. Absolutely. And it's the best way to avoid those, any ill will or, potential hypocrisy. Yeah. Live your values and then people will let other people know.
That's great, man. I love it. Anything else you want to add or any other advice or challenges you want to give to our audience before we wrap up?
Try to do it. Try to be effective. Try to build that trust. And if you need help, there's plenty of good people on LinkedIn who are out there and actively contributing and actively trying to push for these changes. So go out there and check the community and get involved, because we're here for you.
And we'll support you. That's great, Ryan. Yeah, I love it. I think that's a great thing to end on. You can find Brian Britson on LinkedIn. Find him on Twitter at Brian Ethics. And it's a great point, man, that this is a real community. There are a bunch of other people. If you look out around your company and your organization and you don't see a lot of people who get it and you don't see a lot of people who are willing to partner with you, there are a bunch of people like Brian, a bunch of other people on LinkedIn, some whom you've mentioned today, who are actively trying to do this. And it's going to take effort. It's, no one's going to kind of lay the red carpet out and say, hey, can you transform the organization for us? But we have to work at it. And I think as we as ethics experts elevate into positions of leadership and influence and build those bonds across divisions, we're going to be able to make that change that we've been wanting to see. And Brian, I appreciate your heart for this, your contributions to this, and your willingness to come on today and talk with our audience. You've had some great experience. You have a lot of expertise around a bunch of different, elements and actions that ethics experts take. I hope people pick up your challenge and, do what they can to keep trying at it and reach out for help if they need it.
Absolutely. I'm always here to chat.
Well, that's great, man. Thanks so much for coming on. This has been The Ethics Experts with Brian Britson. Please check us on LinkedIn, subscribe on your favorite podcast network, share it with your friends, and we're gonna make the world a better workplace.